The following views and opinions do not necessarily reflect those of AM 1230 WYTS, its staff, management, or parent company, Clear Channel Broadcasting. Listeners should not use Dr. Kvitko's comments and advice in the place of receiving an actual dental exam.
Brighten your life with a smile that shows the professional touch of Dr. Kvitko.
Time now for Dentally Speaking with Dr. Brian Kvitko on AM 1230 WYTS. Call 821-1230. That's 821-1230 to discuss your dental issues. Now, here's your host, Dr. Kvitko on AM 1230 WYTS.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. Today's show is brought to you by Patterson Dental, and I'd like to thank Patterson for stepping up and doing that. I think it's very nice of them to sponsor the show. Today we have an informative show. We're going to be talking about OSHA and infection control. Now, I know that might sound a little dry, but stick with us. I think you're going to find that it's very interesting, very informative, and you'll be glad that you tuned in. Our show is also known as Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Dentistry, but We're Too Numb to Ask. So if you're home and you're not numb, which I assume you're not, unless you're married to a dentist, then go ahead and pick up the phone if you have a question. Our number is 821-1230. Or you can send us an email to dentallyspeaking on am1230@yahoo.com. Today in the studio with me is Karen Daw. I always want to say Karen Dawes for some reason, but it's Karen Daw. She couldn't afford the extra consonant, I guess. But I guess they only charge for vowels, right?
Yes.
Anyway, okay, so Karen is an authorized OSHA trainer and a certified environmental compliance manager. She moved here from Honolulu, Hawaii to Columbus, Ohio in 1993, where she received her Bachelor's of Arts degree in communications from The Ohio State University, and that was in 1997. She went on to earn two MBA degrees with concentrations in organizational business and healthcare management. Since joining The Ohio State University College of Dentistry in 1999, Ms. Daw has received recognition for her contributions to the university and to the field of infection control. She's currently Assistant Director of the Sterilization Monitoring Service and also runs a successful OSHA and infection control consulting business, as well as a service that represents continuing dental education speakers. For the past 10 years, Ms. Daw has consulted and presented on a variety of OSHA compliance and infection control topics for audiences all over Ohio, Michigan, and Tennessee. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Two things. We won't hold against you. I guess that you go to the Michigan, you go up north there and train those people, too.
Well, so they need the education as well as anybody else.
And also, why did you move to Columbus from Hawaii? I think some people are already wondering that.
You know, when you grow up on an island in the middle of the Pacific, and you can circle that in about 2.5 hours, growing up, I always knew I wanted to go to the largest university in the mainland, and that's, you know, what we call you guys out here, the mainland. At the time, it was Ohio State, and the people here have just been so friendly. The weather is not all too dissimilar from that of Hawaii, and so I just decided to stick around.
I think she was teasing. I've been to Hawaii a few times, and I do know that it's funny because when you grow up on the mainland, you always want to go to Hawaii. When you grow up in Hawaii, you want to go to the mainland.
Where
right?
else do you go for vacation?
So something of, anyway, we might get back to that later. But all right, so OSHA training, for people that don't know what that stands for, it's Occupational Safety Health and Health Administration, right?
Yes.
Okay. Which means that they are looking out for the employees. They're looking out for protecting workers. As the owner of a practice my own that is not incorporated, I'm not an employee, so OSHA really doesn't care about me.
Yes, but they're definitely concerned about your employee safety. OSHA falls under the Department of Labor, which is, our federal regulatory agency. Locally here, you have to abide by the Ohio State Dental Board, but OSHA is really only concerned with employee safety. Again, as you mentioned, unless you are incorporated, then you are subject to the same rules and regulations that your employees are subject to.
All right. Now, one of the things we always do is we have Dr. Kvitko's question of the day, and Karen was nice enough to write a couple questions for me because I always like to tie them into our topic. So I'm going to throw that question out now. And in 2007, which is the most recent data that could be located, the question is, what percent of OSHA violations... Oh, wait a minute. That's not the one we want to go with. I want to go with this other one, the one about No, I think that is. We'll go with that one. What percent of OSHA violations were classified as willful or serious violations? And so you can send in your guesses. 2007, of course, we wouldn't expect you to know the stats anyway, but you can give guesses of the OSHA violations that were found, how many were willful or serious. All right? I know Carrie knows the answer because she told me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go, and when I said this is going to be interesting, what I want to do is talk mostly from a patient's perspective. So, besides protecting employees, which by default protects patients, let's talk about infection control, because that's one of the primary things, right, that OSHA is, that and the dental board. The dental board is probably more, well, the dental board is only concerned with patient safety. And
yeah.
It just happens to overlap what OSHA is saying, right?
Exactly, and they're directly linked. I don't think you can protect your patients without indirectly protecting your employees, and vice versa, really. So when a patient comes into a dental practice, and I've done this presentation for the general public as well through the health department, there are certain key things I tell them to look for when they walk into a dental practice, or even beforehand, if they want to call the office ahead of time. Because if you look for these certain key things, you know that they're protecting their patients as well as their employees.
Well, that's really good. I'm going to have you expand on that, because one of my questions was, is there any way that a person can tell if an office isn't practicing good infection control before they've actually received care? I mean, you don't want to find out after the fact that you went to that one office that people were getting sick because of going there. So what can you do?
Exactly. And in the age that we live in, you can Google just about anything. And there are certain topics out there about the top 20 things to look for when you're choosing a dental practice or a healthcare practice. Some of the common things I mention to people when they go, before they even get to a dental practice, is to call up and ask them if they have a safety coordinator. A lot of practices will have somebody that's kind of in charge of heading the infection control protocols for that practice. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a bad practice to visit, but it definitely means that they're on top of things. And some of the questions you want to ask, can I take a look at your weekly sterilization records? The dental board and OSHA both will ask, that's one of the first things that they'll ask for if they ever do investigate your practice. Why not, as a patient, do the same thing? And what I'm talking about when I say sterilization monitoring records, by law here in Ohio, you're required to test your sterilizer on a weekly basis and maintain those records for 2 years on the premises. Any practice that's worth its salt will have those readily accessible and would be willing to share that with you.
Right. Now, people might feel a little bit reticent to ask that kind of question because it could be perceived as standoffish, but my opinion is if they're resistant or take offense to that kind of questioning, maybe that's a red flag. Maybe you are at the wrong office.
I certainly agree with you. I think anybody who's had the proper protocols in place and been practicing and utilizing or incorporating, what OSHA and the dental board expect you to do anyways, it should be a given that that type of information should be public knowledge for you. I think that I would even use it as a marketing tool. Why not put it on your on-hold messages? Why not have your staff engage in conversation with your patients about what you do to protect them? I think they'd feel a lot safer about coming back, especially if it's a first-time patient, and they'd be more willing to tell other people, I noticed that Dr. Kavitko's office does this, whereas the last practice I went to, they didn't do that.
Right. Now, I don't know the country. I wish I could remember, but one of my patients told me a story when they were traveling, and there was a sign on the door of the dental office that said, "We sterilize our instruments every evening." And the implication was, unless you were the first patient of the day, you might not have clean instruments. And I would imagine that's a true story. There are some countries that aren't as developed, that don't have the same facilities. Have you ever heard those kinds of stories?
Not necessarily those, but I'm a little concerned with what some of the state dental boards, not ours here in Ohio particularly, we are required to sterilize to test our sterilizers on a weekly basis. It's a given that we sterilize our instruments in between every patient, but there are some states that don't require monitoring of your sterilizers at all, not even on a monthly basis. It's just they defer to the CDC requirement or recommendation, I should say, that you should be testing your sterilizer on a weekly basis. So I find that kind of disconcerting.
Yeah, Ohio's always been very proactive and very strict in the sense of mandating things that dental offices and dentists do, which I think is a good thing. I do have a question, so let me just explain for folks. The autoclaves that we use to sterilize our instruments have to be tested, and we put a little strip in there. It's in a piece of paper. There's a spore strip. And spores, by the way, are the hardest thing to kill, so if you've killed the spores, you've killed everything else. Sterile, by definition, if you were to look it up, means without life. So, right?
Yes.
Okay, so, and you run the sterilization monitoring service.
Yes, so I'm the assistant
can you
director.
Explain how you can promise me as a dentist or a patient that my autoclave is really working?
Well, after running the spore strip through your sterilizer, you'll mail it into our lab, where we culture it in a tryptochase soy broth media, and every day we're checking for any type of growth in the media. It doesn't indicate that the spores survived your sterilizer cycle. What it does indicate, because TSB media is very nutrient-rich, something is indeed growing in there. What we'll then do is take a sample of that TSB media and then gram stain it and look at it under a 100 times oil immersion microscope lens and confirm the presence of the actual bacillus rods that were originally impregnated on the spore strips. If they do show up, it means the sterilizer failed to kill all the spores on the strips. And I want to mention, too, there's a big difference between sterilization and disinfection.
Right.
One of the horror stories I have is a dental practice where the doctor gave his dental team permission that if they were extremely busy and they could not get around to sterilizing the instruments right away, because you've got to run it through a cycle, and a cycle can take up to an hour to run, that if they were extremely busy, they could clean the instruments and then spray it down with Lysol. Lysol is not a sterilant, it is a disinfectant. So very important.
And this was in Ohio?
I don't want to say.
We're not allowed to say?
We're not allowed to say.
Okay. Well, without mentioning names. But anyway, you work in three states. So it's one of those three states, basically.
Yes, I do primarily work in Ohio. I have been invited to dental practices in some of the other states, and I am definitely willing to travel. This is a topic that I'm very passionate about. I think both the general public as well as the dental team alike both need to be aware of what's required within a dental health care setting.
Well, you know what? This might be a good idea for those dental office personnel that are listening or dental students listening. Let me just give out your information. So if somebody wants to hire you to come in and train their office, or if someone has questions, a patient just happens to have questions that they might feel more comfortable asking you instead of calling their office, you can reach Karen at 614-260-6990, or you can send her an email to theoshalady@yahoo.com. And as usual, no spaces, nothing, right? Just theoshalady@yahoo.com.
Yes.
All right. So I imagine you're pretty busy, and if you send an email, it might take a few days to get a response, or?
It can. I make every effort to check my email several times throughout the day so that I can get back to you right away. And if I don't have the answer immediately, I will respond to you and let you know. It may take some time to research it, but I definitely will get the answer to you.
And this phone number is business hours only, or?
And that's 24/7.
That's
actually something that I give to those dental offices that hire me to come in to do their training and look at their OSHA binders. They get my service for a whole year after that training, because OSHA training is annual. And, you know, if they ever find an OSHA inspector at the door, they can reach me 24/7 that way.
Wow, that's good to know, since I'm up at weird hours. Mm. Although I don't think I'd find an OSHA inspector at my door at 3 in the morning, I would hope.
I would hope not.
On a previous show, I had a question of the day, which was, what percent of dental offices have an H1N1 pandemic flu plan in place for their office? And the answer was 6%, which I considered not very high. Do you know what percent it is now, and what do you think about that percent?
You know, I can only answer based on personal experience, and I can honestly say that this is rather recent. You know, prior to this, we had avian flu. That sparked a lot of interest in the topic of respiratory or stricter respiratory protection within the healthcare setting. As far as H1N1, it was just recently classified as a pandemic, and the dental offices that I've visited recently did not have one in place, did not realize they really needed one. And so I can understand why they would not have one. One of the things I recommend everybody look at is take a look at the news going on in California. Even before there was a bloodborne pathogen standard, the state of California had their own bloodborne pathogen standards in the books. California is one of those states that has their own state-approved OSHA plan. OSHA is federal, which means everybody in all 50 states would have to abide by it. However, if a state wants to have their own plan, it has to meet or exceed the strictness of the federal OSHA plans, and California is one of them. Cal-OSHA actually just passed a respiratory protection mandate for their OSHA regulations, so we may find that may happen eventually here.
When we come back from the break, I want you to give us a little bit of detail and what that has, okay?
Okay.
All right, you're listening to Dentally Speaking, and we'll be right back.
Dentally Speaking is a talk show. Dr. Kavicko, let's go!
You make me smile. We never think
Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kavicko. This week's show brought to you by Patterson Dental. And today we're talking to Karen Daw, who is an OSHA trainer, an educator. She has a couple MBAs. She teaches dental offices how to be in compliance with OSHA rules and infection control and Ohio State Dental Board rules. And so we're talking about infection control, which essentially is safety in the dental office. And one of the things that we were talking about before the break is how Cal-OSHA, which stands for the California Department of Occupation Safety and Health Administration, just passed some new rules, and how there's a chance that those might become the federal rules, right?
Yes, we pretty much find that the federal falls in line with what California proposes, and with the with California passing the H1N1 respiratory protection, we may find that the federal OSHA may require this also of dental offices across the country.
So what are the highlights that are new then to these requirements that would not be there before this passed?
Well, we already have in place, you know, standard or universal precautions in the dental healthcare setting where we're washing our hands routinely, we're changing our gloves in between patients, we're wearing a mask, and we're changing that in between patients. What a respiratory protection act might do is require that we have certain types of masks on. So basically what we're using in the dental office right now would not cut it. We would be switching to probably something like an N95 respirator, which is basically a different type of mask. And you can really pick these up at a Lowe's or a Home Depot, for example.
They're already the ones that somebody might use if they were working with asbestos, say?
Exactly. They're a little form-fitting. They tend to look more like a cup that you fit over your face. It doesn't have, like, the carbon filters. You're not going to look like Darth Vader when you're wearing it, or when you go into dental practice, you're not going to see your hygienist wearing something like that. It looks pretty similar to what they're already using. What we're going to find, though, however, on as a dental care practitioner, is that your overhead's going to increase slightly. But hopefully, if they do have to mass produce these, they'll be able to keep the costs down for the dental practice.
Will there be a problem with availability?
You know, I don't think so. You know, when the swine flu you know, hit the news and the media, there was a run on it, but I was not able to find any articles where they could not keep these in stock when the general public was purchasing these in mass quantities. So I don't think it'll be an issue as far as healthcare facilities being able to obtain these.
Okay, because that was a concern of mine when the H1N1 was first identified, is I actually placed an order for 3 months' worth of masks to make sure that I would still be in business.
Oh, wonderful. Then that's a great idea.
You know, I guess if everybody did that, then there would be.
There probably would be, yes. If everybody thought ahead like Dr. Kavitko, it
so
would.
None of you guys do that, okay? Just me. Anyway, okay, so we'll see a different kind of mask. And to this point, that's all we know of for sure.
Yeah, there's not going to be any type of quarantining. We're not going to have to turn away patients for treatment. So if they find that they have a cough or a sniffle or so, we still want them to come in and get the health care that they need.
Okay. Well, that's good to know, because I know I have a feeling that in the fall, the first sniffle somebody has, they're going to be afraid that it's the H1N1 flu. And more likely than not, it won't be.
Exactly. You know, and it's easy to kind of over-obsess about this when it hits the airwaves. You know, we tend to, I don't want to say the media tends to over-sensationalize it, but that tends to be the buzz topic. So, again, I want to reiterate that there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to go and see your healthcare practitioner. We already take several steps to ensure our safety and ensure the safety of everyone else that comes to see us.
No. Now, we're going to go to a break here soon, but I do have some announcements. So when we come back, though, we're going to ask Karen to answer questions about what a person should do if they feel the infection control procedures aren't up to snuff, what kind of diseases you might contract if you receive dental care at an office with poor infection control, and the kinds of, I guess, punishments and the reasons that you would even find an office not in compliance. So you can ponder those questions. And when we come back from the break, I'll ask you to touch on those for me. Before we go to the break, though, I want to remind folks that our golf outing is coming up. It's August 15th. It is at Broadview Golf Course on Headley Mill Road in Pataskala. And I want to thank, and in fact, we're only talking about a month from now. So now we're moving into let's get some golfers signed up mode, because prior to this, we were asking folks to donate prizes. And I want to thank those people that did so. C.O. Bigelow has donated 2 spa packages, the Ultimate Package and the Night Out Package. Polaris Lifestyle Family Fitness has donated 1 6-month membership. Polaris Magic Mountain has donated 1 family package, including pizza and drinks. We have 6 Columbus Crew tickets to give away, and the crew is now 18. They have not lost a home game in 18 different games, although I guess some of those were ties, but and they won yesterday 3-1 in a great game. Also, the Funny Bone Comedy Club has donated, Easton has donated 2 tickets. Spider Park Paintball has donated 20 free tickets for all-day paintball. That sounds like a lot of fun. Metro Martial Arts has donated a month of free karate lessons and a free uniform. So I think that's very nice of all these businesses to do that. And what it means is if you come out to the golf outing, it's $45 in person. You'll probably leave there with a prize that's worth more than $45. Plus, you will have golfed and had lunch. And it's a scramble start, and all the money goes to the Central Ohio Down Syndrome Association. And so give the office a call at 262-9588 and let them know you'd like to sign up. I did go golfing yesterday and the day before, and I know guys I golfed with yesterday say they're going to come, Tommy and Ryan. And then the day before that, Jimmy and Eric and Chuck, if you guys are listening, give us a call. Don't tell anybody how bad I golf. Because I'm going to try to be better by August 15th. But anyway, all right, you're listening to Dentally Speaking here on AM 1230 WYTS, and we'll be right back.
So hear me when I'm saying, smiling faces.
Welcome back. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. And in the studio with me as my guest is Karen Daw. Karen Daw is a trainer for OSHA and Infection Control Guidelines. She is the executive director or
assistant director
of the Sterilization Monitoring Service, which is at the Ohio State University College of Dentistry. She has her bachelor's degree in communications from Ohio State, and she also earned 2 MBA degrees with concentrating on organizational business and healthcare management. Oh, I could probably use your help on organizational business.
I can find a lot of dental office.
But I do want to thank you for getting up bright and early on this Sunday and coming to the studio with
me. Pleasure to be here.
Very much appreciated. Let's go to those questions that I mentioned and gave you a chance to ponder. Okay, so what should a person do if they suspect infection control procedures are not up to par? What should they do? Should they call the office, talk to the doctor, mention it while they're there, something else?
Well, if it's going on in the middle of a treatment, I would halt the treatment right away and express my concerns. I mean, ultimately, it's your safety on the line here.
So that would be something that obvious would be like not wearing gloves or...
Yeah, I've actually heard of a hygienist that said doctor gave him permission because it reduces tactile sensitivity that they didn't have to wear gloves with patients. So that really, really concerned me because it's a... You know, there's the issue with the patient safety and then your own safety as well there. If it's pretty obvious they're not wearing gloves, they're not changing their gloves, they're reusing the gloves. I've actually heard of that as well.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You know, they might remove their gloves to have to reach into a drawer to grab more gauze, but then they're putting on the same pair of gloves again. And the only way you can do that is by touching the outside of the gloves.
Mm-hmm.
There have also been practices where the doctor would have them use the same pair of gloves throughout the day. Now,
wow.
They're, you know,
how recent was that? I know you can't give names or states, but how recent?
That had to have been within the last 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
And doctor had prepared a diluted bleach solution and would have them dip their gloves in there in between patients but wear the same pair of gloves all day long.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So if you see something like that going on, obviously, I would halt the procedure. But if it's something that, you know, maybe you have some concerns over, you're not quite sure. As I mentioned earlier, most offices will have some sort of safety coordinator or a safety officer. And that's the first point of contact. I would definitely give them a call and ask them and express my concerns and ask them questions. And I'm sure they'll be happy to answer those questions. They'd much rather you ask them than call the dental board, that's for sure.
Right, and honestly, the dental board's probably busy enough if it's something that could be handled. Like, for instance, maybe there's a case where the doctor doesn't know the hygienist is doing it, or the, you know what I mean?
You find that in a lot of cases where doctor's busy seeing
patients. Because I'm not in the room
too.
With him.
Exactly, you're not seeing what's going on, which is why it's kind of nice to have regular meetings with your office staff to remind them what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and break them of some of these habits before they, you know, they've been going on for too long. You may have done it one way in another practice, and now you're at a new practice, and you're doing it the same way where it might not be tolerated.
Now, you mentioned taking a glove off to get something out of a cupboard or a drawer. At my office, we have the handles on those drawers covered with a plastic barrier, so we can open the drawer with our gloved hand, and then we reach in with sterile cotton pliers and pull things out of the drawer. That's okay, right?
That is absolutely acceptable, Dr. Kvitko. And actually, when I did the walkthrough of your practice, I don't think I found anything. You're absolutely 100% in compliance, and I think any OSHA officer with their mustard would have a hard time finding anything wrong with your practice. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. Other practices where I've mentioned to them, they should have barriers, for example, on their X-ray switches. They will express to me, Karen, it's just an added cost. I'm already putting too much money into this. Sometimes they're not aware that these products or devices exist, that that they can cover their handles with these plastic barriers. And sometimes it's just plain laziness. They're aware of it, and they don't want to have to bother because it does add time to changing over the operatory for the next patient.
Yeah, it definitely, it does add time, which is cost, because the longer it takes to turn the room over, the more money is being lost, I guess.
Yep.
On the other hand, you can't compromise on patient care and quality, and so we don't. But, and I've mentioned on the show before, as a society, we expect our government, our governmental agencies to protect us. That's why we have them in place. And but I also think as a society, we're willing to pay the price. We know that it's going to cost a little more, and we're safer because of it. It takes 12 years to bring a new drug to market, for example, and one that maybe has been in Europe for 5 years already before it comes here because of all of the requirements and the trials. So, but I just consider it part of doing business. If the cost of a filling has gone up over the years because of it, I just consider that just, it's like, oh, well, what can we do,
I've actually heard of offices that have gotten into billing disputes, or patients that have gotten into billing disputes with their dental practices, wondering why services have gone up a few dollars, and they have to really, maybe they're not aware, but I want them to understand it's part of the cost of doing business. A dental practice has several different local and federal agencies looking over their shoulders at all times. And with all of these regulations comes cost for them to have to comply. So not only do you have the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, you have the Ohio State Dental Board, you have the Environmental Protection Agency, and they all have certain requirements, and rightfully so, but still, it's going to cost you a little bit. And so it's really important for the patients to understand that. And I always advise dental offices to have that rapport with their patients, explain to them, maybe before the costs go up, exactly why they're going to see an increase on their next bill and why, what that entailed.
Well, that's actually not a bad idea. And there are some other agencies that you didn't mention, the health department, for example. They
radiology.
Come out and check our radiology mm-hmm. equipment to make sure it's safe and that that everything is labeled mm-hmm. correctly. And then we have the fire department comes every year to make sure our fire extinguishers are, they actually come.
It's that your building's up to code. Yeah,
right.
There are a lot of entities. Whoever said owning your own business was going to be a joy. I mean, it's really not all it's cracked up to be. There are so many rules and regulations you have to adhere to as a business owner in the healthcare industry.
Yeah, it's kind of like, how they say anybody who thinks money buys happiness has never had money. I mean, isn't it? Because, and the same thing with owning your own business. The people that say, I want to own my own business someday, if they only knew,
Exactly.
I mean, I do it, and I do enjoy what I do, but there are times when it just, it's like, is there anybody else? Can there be any more people that have a say? But we have to do the right thing. So we make sure our fire extinguishers are charged. We make sure that we have the barriers. We make sure that the X-ray machines are properly calibrated and labeled, so that when somebody comes, a patient comes, they can know that they're going to be safe,
Yep.
So We do have to go to another break. And when we come back, I have many, many more questions, probably more than I'll be able to get to, but I'll certainly try. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on AM 1230 WYTS, and we'll be right back.
Smile.
Welcome back to Dentally Speaking, this week's show brought to you by Patterson Dental. Today we're talking about patient safety in the dental office as it applies to infection control, making sure that your dental office is clean and safe, and that the sterilizer is working so that we know you have sterile instruments, and that the employees or the staff are wearing gloves and that they're changing them and all of that. And so Ms. Daw, Karen Daw, is one of the people that goes out and trains dental offices on how to be compliant with the Ohio State Dental Board rules and with OSHA rules and even the health department. Now, I have a question. So if you find an office isn't in compliance, what's the usual reason that you're being told? Is it lack of knowledge? Is it lack of understanding? Is it financial? Do you see a pattern, meaning is it due to age? Are the younger dentists doing it and the older dentists not? Are the older dentists doing it and the younger dentists not? Is it related to maybe a training, maybe a foreign-trained dentist as opposed to a U.S.-trained dentist? I know that's a lot out there, but just kind of give me a sense of what you're finding.
The reasons for lack of compliance would have to probably be all of the above. They might not have been aware. There might have been some ignorance. They're aware, and they just don't understand why they need to implement it if they've always done it a certain way, and now all of a sudden they're being told they need to do it a different way. Cost is a factor, which should never be a factor. And just laziness, you know, like I said earlier, you know, it takes time to turn over an operatory when you've got to replace all these barriers. You've got to disinfect. This disinfectant has to sit on there for X amount of minutes. Then you've got to let it dry before the patient sits down. I mean, there are a lot of steps involved. As far as the makeup of the type of people that I see that are not in compliance, perhaps when I mention the ones that don't understand why they need to do it, you do find sometimes some of the older dentists, I mean, they may not understand why. You know, we talked before the show how at one time dentists and hygienists were not required to have to wear gloves or you know, change them in between patients. A lot of requirements have come into play just within the last decade alone. And, you know, people naturally resist change. So if you can't explain to them in a way that makes them understand why it's necessary to do something, you find that they don't want to do it.
Well, but these are highly educated people who have had microbiology and understand transmission of disease.
And it's a scary thought. And those that are aware but don't do it, I mean, there's just no excuse for that. And there are dental practices that will argue with me, tooth and nail. I'll come in and I'll say, you know, you should be doing this. You need to be doing that. And back them up with all of the data. And I'll even provide them with the OSHA codes. They'll still fight me on it. So, unfortunately, I wish I could make a list of the dental practices not to go to, because that would be a nice long list. But fortunately, there are plenty of dental practices out there that I would definitely recommend my family and friends to be able to go to.
And so we think that there will be some obvious signs, because, again, somebody can call up and they can ask questions. They can go and ask for a tour.
That the tour idea, I think, is a wonderful idea, and I've actually been in practices where they have said it was based on, I think it was a Dateline or a Nightline special in about healthcare facilities, and one of the things that you should do to acquaint yourself with a practice is to request a tour. And I've actually heard of dental practices saying, you know what, Karen, that's so funny you should mention that, because we actually had a patient call up and want to tour our instrument processing area. Now, what does a patient know about an instrument processing area? Well, they didn't know anything until they saw it on television, and now they learn a little bit more about all the things that go into ensuring their safety when they come to a dental practice.
Right, all that behind the scenes.
All behind the scenes stuff, yes.
Now, we would be happy to give people tours. We have the sterilization area is an area that is normally off limits to the public because of, safety.
Yes, I always recommend that, you know what, if you have 15 minutes to spare before you open, obviously I wouldn't recommend that they tour it when there's patient treatment going on, but maybe during your staff lunch break, mm-hmm. in the morning before the office opens, you know, it's only another step that reassures everything that goes into ensuring their safety. And if they feel comfortable with coming to you regularly, they'll be back, and then they're going to tell their friends and family about your practice.
Great, that's great. Now that you mentioned, I think a good time would be on a day when maybe we only work half a day, not a half, well, when we're closed. You know, I've had people come through and everything's nice and clean, and you can walk somebody through there without having to worry about them contracting a disease, I guess, or picking up a germ. All right, we do have to go to another break. I want to thank Patterson Dental for sponsoring today's show. When we come back, we have some more questions for Karen. And Karen, it's become pretty clear to me that we're not going to get through all of this, so I'd like to invite you back if you would commit to that.
It would be my pleasure to be back.
Okay, let's do that at some point down the road. You're listening to Dentally Speaking on AM 1230 WYTS, and we'll be right back. Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. This week's show brought to you by Patterson Dental. And we are talking to Karen Daw, who is an MBA, multiple MBA, and a CECM, which I'm going to ask her to explain that in a minute because I already forgot, even though she told me. But anyway, Karen will give us that in a minute. I just realized I got so involved in talking to Karen that I haven't really dealt with Dr. Kvitko's question of the day. So what I'm going to do is just give out the answer. I haven't even checked my emails. I'm sorry about that. So if you sent me an email and you're right, I'll send you a congratulations during the week here. But anyway, the question was, in 2007, which is the most recent data available, how many OSHA violations were classified as willful or serious? And the answer is 82%, which I think is very high. And what I'd like to do is ask Karen to explain what willful or serious means.
OSHA has a hierarchy of the citations that, you know, obviously, just like the dental board does, there might be some infractions that you can correct immediately, and then some of them are considered willful or serious. And what that is you're aware of what you need to be doing. For example, you're aware that you should have an exposure control plan in place in your OSHA manual, or you're aware that you're supposed to provide your employee with baseline blood work after a needle stick exposure or a needle stick injury, for example, and you don't send them out to get that blood work done, or they're not aware of what they need to do in the event of an exposure. That OSHA considers willful or serious, and that can carry with it up to a $75,000 per incident fine.
How much?
$75,000 per incident.
Do you That's five digits.
75,000. Are we likely to see that in dentistry? You know, for years and years, I've been saying there's absolutely no way. However, in Concord, New Hampshire, and this is something that you can even pull up on OSHA.gov, a dental office was cited with willful and serious fines, and that was $76,500 in proposed fines total. And that's a dental office.
Wow, that's very scary. Which is why we have OSHA, why we have the dental board. They don't want to fine dentists, they just want them to comply.
Exactly. We can't look at them as the bad guy. They definitely have a role, and they definitely serve a purpose. And based on some of the horror stories I can tell you, which we might have to save for the next show, you really would be amazed. You really would be amazed. And when you consider that, I think there's just a little over five, I think there might be seven now, dental investigators for the entire state of Ohio. They have a hefty responsibility to ensure patient safety.
Yeah, that's only seven. I'm amazed.
I think it was seven at the last time. You know, it might be slightly higher than that,
okay.
But when you consider that's for the entire state of Ohio, it's still not nearly. They could have, you know, 20, and I don't think that'd be enough.
And they physically go to the office. It's not all by mail or email. None of it's by mail or email. It's all they physically show up.
It can be complaint generated, or they can do what's called a random infection control inspection. And every dental office faces the same opportunity of being inspected by the dental board within any given year. So just because you received a random infection control inspection 1 year within a biennium does not necessarily mean you're excluded the following year.
Okay. Gee, we're almost out of time. May not be fair, but I'm going to ask you anyway. How long does a dentist have to become compliant once they're found to not be in compliance?
If it's a minor infraction, usually the dental board investigator or nose investigator will say, you know, hey, you need to do this, and then that'll be the end of it. But a lot of times OSHA will give you 15 days. It's an abatement period to come into compliance.
Okay. So it's a short leash.
It is.
Which is good, which is what it ought to be. All right, Karen, again, thanks so much for being with me, and I look forward to when you come back.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to that date.
And let's remember to give out your phone number. If people would like to book you to train their office, it's 614-260-6990. Or email the OSHA lady at yahoo.com. And call my office at 262-9588 to sign up for our golf outing. Thank you very much. See you next Sunday morning at 9.